Okay, so we can get in as much information as possible. Let's get started. I would like to introduce you to a man who's been going throughout our synod the last couple of years. He simply goes by the name of Jacob. It's for his safety and security, I understand, that he just goes by the name Jacob. He's going to tell us a very interesting story this morning. He grew up in the country of Iraq, was taught in the ways of Islam, came to our country and became a Christian, became a member of our synod, of the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. And I won't tell you anything more about him because he has a very interesting way of telling his story by himself. So welcome to St. Mark's, Jacob.
Thank you. For a minute, I was worried that he was going to continue telling my story. I was like, stop it. And by the way, I'm known as Jacob because I'm like Madonna. I have one name, so it's Jacob. So that's all. Well, thanks for inviting me this morning to make a special presentation and also to introduce myself throughout the presentation to you guys and inform you about this new mission that we have started at the Wells Synod, which is called the Outreach to Muslim Team. The team is basically myself, and there's a pastor also associated with me, but he doesn't travel long distance with me. So now I'm here in California. This is actually my third time in California, and I always said that California is a very interesting state. You can find almost anything you want. There's mountains, there's valleys, there's rivers, there's desert, there's the ocean, weird people, you know, all kinds of stuff. So whatever you look for, you find it here. And also, I can tell that you guys are good Lutheran because the first row is empty. You know, so that's well, the pastor sits there. See, I was told in the beginning that the good Lutherans sit in the back and the not-so-good Lutherans sit in the front row. So, well, enough. I'll introduce myself by telling you that when I first came to America, I didn't speak English as much, and I wasn't even a Christian. Of course, you know, that tells you I was not born in America. And in fact, I come from the country of Iraq. Iraq has been in the news for the past 5 years because of the war and everything else is going on over there. You are pretty much familiar with some of the things in Iraq, but I will try to explain a little bit more about Iraq and the nature of that country and the population as well. I want to understand if you guys hear me in that corner. Can you hear me? In this corner too? Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Well, good, good. Iraq is a country that has 96% Muslims, believe in the religion of Islam, and about 80% Arab, the Arabic race who speak Arabic language and the Arabic culture. However, those people are not united among themselves. They're divided. And the division goes like this. This part of the country is known as the Sunni Triangle. This is where majority of the people and the population are Arab, Muslim, but they are Sunni division of Islam. And you have the southern part of Iraq. This territory is known as the Shia-dominated territory. The population in this part of the country are also Arab, Muslim, but they are Shia division of Islam. And those two people are not getting along. They don't like each other. They have been in conflict with each other for a long time. I sometimes say since humans were monkeys. But that's a joke, that humans were never monkeys. And then there is another part of, or another group of people that live within the country of Iraq, and those are the Kurds. The Kurds live in the northeastern part of Iraq. This area is known as Kurdistan. Kurdistan is the northeastern part of Iraq, and the population there are Kurds. It's different from the Arabs. It's a different language, it's a different culture, and a different race. However, the religion is predominantly, unfortunately, Muslim or Islam. And a little bit about Kurdistan. This area has been divided throughout the history into four parts or four divisions. And especially since 1918, after the British took over the country of Iraq, they divided Kurdistan into four parts. There is a bunch of Kurds, or a population of Kurds in Iran. Those are known as the Iranian Kurds. There are a population of Kurds in Turkey, the Turkish Kurds. And there's a smaller part of Kurdistan in Syria. And besides that, there is the Iraqi Kurds who live in this area. And I was born to an Iraqi Kurdish family, which would make me an Iraqi Kurd. I was born to a Muslim family, and we grew up in that culture, learning about Allah and Muhammad and the Quran. As the age of 7, they teach you about the Quran. And as soon as you go to school, in public schools in those cultures, they also teach you the Quran and the traditions of Islam and the things that you need to do in order for you to be a good Muslim. So we had to memorize and learn the Quran, because the Quran is in Arabic, but I had to learn the Arabic language so I can understand and memorize it. The first time I have ever heard about Jesus is when I was 5 years old, or maybe four. When I was a kid, about 5 or 4 years old, one of my neighbors were Christian in the neighborhood. And the kids our age were, one day, they were playing with eggs. The eggs that they colored, different colors. And they were showing us these eggs. And they were talking about Jesus being God. Of course, you know, now I know that was Easter. And they were showing us the colored eggs of the Easter. At the time, I didn't know what it was. But that's my memory, my first memory of hearing about Jesus being God. And, of course, later when I went to school and they started teaching us Quran, I pretty much forgot about that incident. And I started learning about Allah and Muhammad and the Quran and those things. And in a way, that helped me very much. When I read the Quran in school and being taught by teachers who were professionally Muslim teachers who knew a lot about Islam, it helped me understand Islam in the accurate way. Right from its source, which was the Quran, the Hadith, and the life of Muhammad and the traditions of Islam. And so I grew up going to school in elementary, in middle school, and high school. By the time I was in high school, I was very much, you could say, an expert in the religion of Islam. And I knew pretty much everything that I needed to understand about this religion. But ironically, the more I understood Islam, the more my knowledge deepened in Islam, the less it attracted me to it. And the more I was skeptic of this religion, because there's a lot of teachings that are very disturbing, very inhumane, especially when it talks about infidels and women and all those things. I just did not feel comfortable with this religion. However, I couldn't always voice my concerns or my criticism of Islam, because you don't do that in cultures like any country that is predominantly Muslim. However, there was one friend of mine who was a very close friend. Sometimes you can find things into your friends that you don't usually do, even with your own family. My friend and I would usually discuss religion and theologies and philosophies and sort of thing when I told him about my doubts about Islam. And he said, I'm going to bring you a book, and I want you to read this book and tell me what you think about it. So the next day he came back to school, and he brought me a book. And he said, read this book and let me know what you think. And the book was titled The Theory of Evolution by Charles Darwin. Some of you heard of that theory. And it says we come from one cell, and then we evolved into something, and then we become monkeys, and then we became humans. Of course, the Quran says the opposite. The Quran says monkeys were, you know, humans and became monkeys. I mean, the humans were humans and then became monkeys. It goes the opposite. I'll tell you that story later. And I took this book home and I started reading A Theory of Evolution. And the more I understood this theory, it made me unstable, actually, in my intellect and my spirit. And even my faith in Islam. And I started losing my faith in Islam even faster than I used to. And by the time I was done with reading The Theory of Evolution, I completely lost my faith in Islam as a religion, and Allah as a God, and heaven and hell and all that stuff. And I decided that I am an atheist. I became an atheist. I thought religion doesn't do me any good. I didn't feel any comfortable with being a Muslim, even though I practiced it, but it wasn't comfortable. The history of this event was close to the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein. Some of you are young enough to remember that. I said young enough, so. What happened in that time was Saddam Hussein, how many of you heard of the name Saddam Hussein? Well, good. Saddam occupied or conquered the country of Kuwait, a small country south of Iraq. Of course, the international communities rejected this move, and they formed the coalition forces of 33 countries, including United States. Well, actually, led by United States, and they took their armies and troops into the desert of Saudi Arabia, and they were ready to fight Saddam Hussein over the country of Kuwait. So there was a war between the Iraqis and the coalitions in the southern part of Iraq over the country of Kuwait. This war, while it was going in the south, it gave the Kurds in the northeastern part of Iraq an advantage in terms of numbers. So there are no enough Iraqi soldiers to keep us under control. And also with the encouragement of the George Bush the father, the senior, there was an uprising among the Kurds. The ordinary people of Kurdistan led a civil uprising against all Iraqi installation throughout Kurdistan. So through the Gulf War, Kurdistan was liberated from Saddam Hussein and his troops. Unfortunately, that didn't last very long because once the coalitions defeated Saddam Hussein and they kicked him out of Kuwait, they decided to stop the war, and there was a ceasefire between the Iraqis and the coalition forces. This ceasefire gave Saddam Hussein, again, another chance to put his armies back together and march and come back to Kurdistan. So here's thousands of Iraqi troops are coming back from the south towards the north, and they're going to take over again after they lost the control of the area. Of course, as Kurds who lived in the area for, there were actually about 3 million Kurds in this area, we were very nervous. We were very scared that the Iraqis are going to come back. And some of you know a little bit about Saddam Hussein. He was a ruthless man. He wouldn't spare any way to establish his dominance or his power. So we didn't know if he's going to, you know, kill and annihilate and imprison anyone in the way. So the idea was to empty the cities and escape. Everyone, the notion was to empty the cities and escape towards either Turkey or Iran. And I personally, my idea was to escape to the country of Iran, because I lived in the city of Suleimaniyah near the border of Iran. But there were two major obstacles in my way. One of them was the transportation. I mean, I didn't have any way to get there, but to walk towards Iran. And the other obstacle was the nature of the land. The nature of the land in Kurdistan is a rugged terrain. There's a lot of mountains and valleys that surrounds that area. And in particular, there's this mountain that surrounds my city, the city that I lived in, from three different sides. So my idea of escaping was to climb this mountain and continue walking towards Iran. Instead of walking around the mountain, I would have climbed it. That would have been a faster way to get out of the country, the city. And the day came when the Iraqis were approaching our town, and the tanks were coming in, and there was bombs and everything, explosions. We could hear it. It's coming. And I started my flight and started climbing this mountain along with hundreds of other people. And it was a cloudy day. It was starting to rain. And I was almost halfway. She says me. That's exactly where I was when the Iraqis entered the city. It was too late. I was almost to the top, but I was halfway there when they entered the city from this side. This dark line, I don't know if it's visible to you guys. This dark line here is a highway that surrounds that town that I lived in. And so they entered through that highway. And so there's all kinds of army equipments on this highway, like tanks and armored vehicles and so on, and Iraqi soldiers. And I was up here along with a bunch of people trying to escape the same way I was trying to do. And once the Iraqis entered, they stopped on this highway and they started talking to us with their loudspeakers. They were telling us to get off the mountain and surrender, get down and surrender to them. Of course, I didn't want to do that. Nobody else wanted to do that because we knew that's not something you do with the Iraqis. You can't trust them. And after a while, they got frustrated with us and they gave us a warning. They said, if you guys don't get off that mountain, we'll start shooting you anyways. So when they gave us that warning, I was very... that was a moment that I thought to myself, this is getting serious and it's getting dangerous, and I am going to face my death very soon. It's very imminent. And I was worried about two things, actually. One of them was, of course, losing my life over that mountain. And the other one was my spiritual identity. At the time, I considered myself to be an atheist, but in the same time, I usually had this little voice in my head that always questioned my atheism. And I always questioned it, and I thought, what if I die and I find out that there is a God? Then that's a big problem, especially if it's Allah. He's going to punish me real bad, you know. And so at that moment, I figured something. I thought, this is a good time to change my mind, you know. And start thinking about a God that can help me here, get me out of this situation. And then I thought to myself, well, who? I don't want to pray to Allah. But I thought, I remember that one thing from when I was five and these kids showing us these eggs and talking about Jesus being God. And I thought, Jesus was, you know, these people were talking about him being God, so maybe I should pray to him. And so I'm sitting in this mountain and I'm seriously, you know, worried for my life. And I give my heart right then and I ask Jesus to help me. Either save me, get me out of here, or if I die, in case that happened, forgive me. And after I said that prayer, something happened at the time that, in my mind at the time, I thought it was a weather change. Because like I said, it was a cloudy day, it was raining. But then after I said that prayer, the clouds came low enough, it started to become misty and cloudy right up the mountain. And the upper part of that mountain became cloudy. And that cloud acted like a blanket, like a shield between us and the Iraqis who were down in the bottom. They were down here and we were up there. And that cloud was there to cover us. And that's when I realized this is my chance to get out of here, because now they can't see us and I can move freely and try to get to climb to the mountaintop. So I quickly climbed to the mountaintop, and I noticed that everyone was trying to do the same thing and get to the mountaintop. Once I got to the mountaintop, I felt much, much safer, and I realized that it is safer to be here because we're out of range and they can't see us. But I knew that's not the end of it. I still have to continue walking towards Iran. And I didn't know how to get there. And there's all these people coming up, and I asked one of the people, how do you go to Iran? And they told me, Iran is in the east. I'll continue walking towards the east. And in probably 2 days, you'll get there. So I continued walking. I'm right here, and I'm supposed to go towards the east and get to Iran in 2 days. And I walked. I walked a day and 2 days and 3 days, and 3 days became four and five and 6 days. It took 6 days to get to Iran. At the time, I was puzzled. I thought, why did it take me 6 days? What happened? Something must have went wrong. And I didn't know until later when I looked through the map of Iraq and traced myself. I realized that I went from here to here. Yeah. I didn't know that I could have went this way and it would have been a shortcut. But like I always say, this is just, it's really true. I learned a valuable lesson, and I say this to the men because men have a problem with this. If you're ever lost, just stop and ask for directions, you know. Well, nowadays you don't need that with GPS systems and things, you know. Anyways, this whole mass exodus thing, there was a huge number of people who were trying to escape Iraq towards Iran and Turkey. There was actually about 2.5 million, they estimated at the time, who were refugees over the mountains of Kurdistan. And so this caused a humanitarian crisis. There were a lot of people who were hungry and thirsty and dying. Women were having babies in the mountain, and older people were dying. And so the United Nations interfered to stop this this crisis. And what they did is that they asked the coalition forces to establish something called no-fly zone. The no-fly zone was like a virtual line, a protective area over Kurdistan where the American airplanes would fly and stop the Iraqis from attacking the Kurds. And they also forced Saddam Hussein and his troops to withdraw south of this line. So virtually, the no-fly zone gave Kurdistan another shot of being a liberated area and have no Saddam Hussein in the area. And this no-fly zone encouraged all of the refugees over the mountains to come back to the cities and start their lives normally again. So I came back from Iran, back to my town. Also, no-fly zone had another advantage. It encouraged a lot of organizations, humanitarian organizations from Europe and the United States to come to Kurdistan to help rebuild the infrastructure of the area. Because in the past, Saddam Hussein had destroyed 5,000 villages and he also buried 30 million landmines all over Kurdistan. So these Americans and Europeans came up to clean up the landmines and to rebuild the villages and, you know, roads and all that kind of things, and help people go back to their homelands. 5 years later, in 1996, an Italian, how many Italians here? Oh, one. How many German? Yeah. Okay. How many Kurds? So no worries, you know, I'm the only Kurd, you're the only Italian, so. An Italian organization came to my town, and they built a small cheese factory. It was an experimental cheese factory. They were buying the milk from the farmers there. It was like a stimulus economic little project in the area. And I had just graduated from College of Agriculture, and my major was in food science and food technology. So that gave me a chance to work with them, with the Italians, to make cheese. But our salary came from the United States organizations. So it was a combination of American and Italian work. However, that didn't last very long either, because at the end of 1996, Saddam Hussein violated the no-fly zone, and he attacked Kurdistan for the second time. And for the second time, I had to escape, almost same route. But this time, I learned my lesson, and so I went this way and saved myself some time. Once I got to Iran for the second time, I was in a refugee camp along with thousands of other people. About a month later, the news came to us from Italy, from my employer in Italy. They told us that all of the locals, the Kurds who worked for Americans and Europeans, must try to somehow to get to the Turkish border, because the United States government had organized a rescue operation, an airlift, an evacuation type of thing, to bring all of the locals, the Kurds that worked for them, bring them into the United States and give us political asylum for our safety. So I had to find a way to go back into Iraq and then go to the Turkish border. At the Turkish border, there were actually Americans waiting, and about 1,000 people like me that worked for organizations throughout Kurdistan. And so they put us on buses. They took us to an airport in Turkey. From there, they flew us to Abu Dhabi, from there to Sri Lanka, from there to the island of Guam. The island of Guam. Any of you been in Guam? Why? Why? Navy. You been in Guam? What did you do in Guam? Okay. Guam. Huh? Guam is a small island. No Welsh churches in Guam. No, don't worry. It's a small island. It's basically an Air Force base and a Navy base. And we stayed in the Air Force base along with the other refugees. And about 3 months later, they called up my name and they said, get ready to go to the United States. There is someone that sponsored you. So they took me back to the airport in Guam, and from there they flew me to Hawaii. Hawaii. Of course, you've been in Hawaii, some of you, right? Been in Hawaii? Did you like it? Well, I liked it too. I said, can I stay here? And they said, no. And the other thing that was kind of different or strange was when I left Guam, the day was Monday and the time was 11:30 at night. When I landed in Hawaii, it was Monday noon, same day. So I was like, that's different. And then from there, they flew me to San Francisco, right here, over there. In San Francisco, when I landed, the time was night, and I was confused. It was a long flight, and I didn't know what time or what day it was. So I asked one of the bypassers, what time is it? And they said, it's 11:30. And I said, what day? And I said, it's Monday. Same day. The same time, I left Guam, I landed in San Francisco, same day, same time. And 2 years later, when I was in America, I saw a movie called Groundhog Day. And I thought, I've been there, you know. Just, I've seen that happen to me, too. Well, anyways, in San Francisco airport, they separated us from regular passengers, and they said, you guys go to the immigration office so they can tell you where is your destination in America. I went to the immigration office. They read my name, and they said, you've been sponsored by the YMCA. I thought, YMCA, great. I'm going to see the village people. You know. So we're doing the YMCA, right? And they're like, nah, the YMCA is just a refugee sponsoring agency. So I was disappointed again. They're like, okay, where in America you're going to send me to? They said, you are sponsored in Houston, Texas. And I thought, Texas? I don't want to go to Texas. That's full of cowboys. They shoot each other, you know. You know? And they're like, no, you'll be okay. None. I was like, okay, that's not bad. Houston, Texas. I thought, first thing that came to my mind was, this is real America. I'm going to go and mix with real Americans. And my first thought was to practice my English. Because like I said, when I first came here, I didn't speak as well. And I thought, this is great. This is my chance to go there and practice it right away. So they flew us to Texas. There were a bunch of us. And in Houston, the YMCA was there. But no village people, of course, no. And they took us from the airport, and they put us in an apartment building. Said, you guys are going to stay here until we do your paperwork and stuff. And I was very excited. The next day, I woke up, and I started walking around in Houston and looking for people to speak English to see how good my English is. So while I'm walking, I saw something. It was a huge grocery store named Fiesta. And I thought, oh, great, I'm going to go there. There's all kinds of people, and I can speak English to the people. And I walk in Fiesta, and I start, you know, like little things like, how much is this, what's this? And I'm trying to speak little English here and there. And nobody spoke English, you know. Zero. I was like, uh-oh, the YMCA made a mistake. And I thought, they sent me to a different country. I was like, wait a minute. So I go back to the YMCA, and it's like, is this America? And they said, yes. I said, okay, well, where's the English-speaking people? Huh? They said, well, this is Houston. Majority of the people in this area, in this town, they speak Spanish. So you either have to learn Spanish, or if you don't like it, you can get out of here, you know. So I was like, door number two, get out of here. So I'm in Houston. I'm trying to get out of Houston. Until one day, I was talking to a friend of mine who was sponsored in Virginia. He ended up in Virginia. And I was talking to my friend about, I wanted to get out of Houston. And he said, well, why don't you talk to my sponsor? Maybe they can help you. And his sponsor was this American lady that worked for the government in the D.C. area. And she asked me, the first thing she asked me was my job experience. She said, well, what did you do in Iraq? I said, well, the last thing I did was making cheese. Well, Italians. And she said, well, maybe I can help you. So she gave me two telephone numbers. She said, call these people and see if they want help. One of them was from Vermont. The other cheese factory was in Wisconsin. So I called the Vermont cheese factory, and I asked them that, I know a little bit about cheese making, and if I'd like to work with you guys. And they said, well, that's good. What kind of cheese do you used to make? I said, I used to make cheese from cows. They said, sorry, you only make cheese from goat milk, so we don't need you. And I thought, okay. I called the Wisconsin Cheese Factory, and I left a message. 2 days later, a man called me back, and he introduced himself, and he said he is the owner of a cheese factory. He owned a small cheese factory in Wisconsin. And he said, and he started talking to me about my experience and asked me questions, and he liked my experience. He said, why don't you come to Madison in Wisconsin to meet me for an interview? And I said, I don't really know how to travel in this country. I'm new. Yeah, so I can't really. And he said, okay, I have a meeting in Dallas next week. Come meet me in Dallas. I said, where's Dallas? I don't know where Dallas. But Dallas, I was playing hard to get, so. But actually, he was very nice, and he said, that's fine. I can come from Dallas and meet you in Houston. And I thought, that's very nice of him to be willing to do that. He agreed to come and meet me the next week. But before we hang up the phone, he said, I have to tell you something that's very important. It's probably, you'll be sensitive to this. I said, what is it? He said, I am Jewish. The guy that I was talking to was a Jew. And of course, for me, I've never met a Jew in my life. I've never spoke to a Jew in my life. I had no idea what Jews look like or what they appear like. Except one thing I have known about Jews from the Quran. Quran chapter 2, verse 65. If you read that, just read it for entertainment. Go get a Quran chapter 2, verse 65. Allah in this verse says that he was angry at a Jewish tribe and he cursed them by turning them into monkeys and pigs. So that's the opposite of Darwin's theory. Darwin says we come from monkeys. Allah says monkeys come from the Jewish people. So I was kind of nervous about meeting this guy. I was like, is this guy going to be a monkey or a pig? I've never met a Jew. So the next week he came to Houston, and he turned out to be a white guy, nothing else. So him and I talked and discussed work things, and he said, he liked my experience. He said, I'd like to offer you a job. He said, I'll pay you this amount of money per hour and help you to move. Come work for me. I said, well, I have to think about it. I have to think about it. Okay. And he said, I couldn't wait for it, And he said, okay, great. Then I'm going to send you to Lebanon. I was like, wait a minute, Lebanon? I don't want to go to Lebanon. I just came from Middle East. He said, no, don't worry. Lebanon is a small town in Wisconsin. I was like, really? He said, yes. I said, do they speak English? He said, yes. I said, okay, I'm going to Lebanon. So here I go to Wisconsin, and I see Power of Cheese. And I thought, I'm in the right place. Well, anyways, this move, this transformation, this transition happened around the end of 1997. Any Packer fans here? Any Packer? Just one, two. All right. To those of you who are Packer fan and not Packer fan, in that year the Packers were doing great. They're going to the Super Bowl for the second time. And so I just moved to Wisconsin, and I had no idea who the Packers were. And I had no idea what football was. So everywhere I go in Wisconsin, I see this, you know. So I was like, so I asked the people, what is this stuff on your heads? What is that? And they said, that's Cheesehead. I was like, okay, what's the purpose of Cheesehead? Is that to keep the rain, the snow? What is this, you know? They said, well, that's a Packer thing. If you like to know more about the Packers, go watch football games. So I thought, okay, maybe I should see what is this football they talk about all the time. So one day I was home and watching TV. It was a weekend, and I'm flipping channels, and there was a football game on TV. And the first thing I saw in this football game was these big, massive, large, athletic men piled up on top of each other. And I thought, that doesn't look right, you know. And then they stand up and they run towards each other, and they hit each other so hard and violently. And I thought, man, that's so unintelligent, you know, or not so smart, you know. Why are they doing this? And the other thing I noticed in this game is like, wait a minute, you call this game football, and all you do is throw it with your hands and run with it. You know, you hardly kick the thing. I used to play soccer, and that's what you call football outside of America. And so I'm telling my American friends, why do you guys call this game football when you don't even kick it? Why don't you call it pylon ball? You know, let's beat each other ball, you know. And they're like, well, this is America. That's how we do things. So get over it, you know. Like, okay, get over it. Well, anyways, moving to Wisconsin made another change in me, another transformation. Remember in the beginning I said I was an Iraqi Kurd? When I moved to Wisconsin, I became a cheese curd. So it's transformation here. So you have a Iraqi Kurd making cheese curd in Lebanon. Very weird combination of things. Anyways, I worked in Lebanon, and I lived in another town that's small. It's about, they call it water town. It's about 10 miles apart. And I stayed in the area for about 3 years. 3 years later, one day I came home from work, and there was a message on my telephone. Something like this. We'd like to welcome you to this town as a newcomer. Please come visit our church. So I picked up the phone, I dialed the number back, and it was an older lady on the other side. And I was puzzled with one thing. I asked her, how did you guys know that I was a newcomer? And she said, well, we are the Wells people in this town. We know everything. So I thought, wow. Wow, you guys are really good, you know. But you're not that good because I've been here 3 years, you know. I'm not a newcomer, you know. So anyways, I go visit the church, and I met a pastor. And the pastor and I talked a little bit, and he asked me about where I was from and stuff. And I told him, and he said, "What have I ever read the Bible?" I said, "No, I've never read the Bible. I have no idea what the Bible is." He said, "Well, would you like to study the Bible with me?" And I thought, why not? Are you going to charge me money? He said, no. I said, okay. You know. And so the pastor and I started meeting on a regular basis, about once a week for about an hour. And we studied the Bible together. And the things that I learned from this Bible was shocking to me at the time. It was just shocking to see or understand that there could be any kind of teaching like this. And it was so different from all of the other religions and teachings that I've ever read in my life. And especially when the pastor and I were doing the comparison between Islam and Christianity, and I came across this verse in the Quran, chapter 9, verse 111. Quran is the holy book of Islam. In this chapter, Allah says, He had purchased of the believers their persons and their goods, and for theirs in return is the garden of paradise. They fight in His cause, and they slay and are slain. This is a promise that Allah gives to His followers. Now, look at this verse and ponder and think what this means. It's like this. Allah is the God of the Muslims. And the believers, of course, are the Muslims themselves, the people. And here's a transaction between Allah and the believers. He says to them, if you give me your life, if you give me your possessions, if you give me everything you own, and if you go and fight for me, and you go and kill people, and also if you get killed by people, then I will give you the garden of paradise. Isn't that what that means? Right? He says that if you fight in his cause and do all these things, then I can give you the garden of paradise. It's an exchange. But notice one thing that's very important. Allah, as the God of Islam, he does not contribute. He does not give anything he should. He does not associate himself in this salvation. He does not participate in this salvation. He's just there, up there, like a judge, waiting for the people to perform. And how good they perform depends on where they go at Judgment Day. And then when we compare that to what the Bible says, especially in John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he gave his one and only Son. And whoever believes in him shall not perish and have eternal life. And that's when I read this verse, that's when I felt like the Spirit, the Holy Spirit is entering in me. And regardless of whether I understood Christianity or I didn't understand it, it didn't matter after that. It was like the Spirit was the one that's making the decision for me to wanting to become a Christian. And the reason why, I mean, I'm not trying to intellectualize it, but if you compare this verse to what the Quran says, here's what you find out. First of all, God says he loves the world. That's something you will never find or see or read in the Quran or even the Hadith. Go read the whole Quran. You'll never see anything that says Allah loved the world because he's not a loving God. Secondly, God says here that he is giving. He's the one that gives. And what is he giving? The most precious possession at the time, his son Jesus. And to do what? To die. To die on the cross for me at the point, for me, so I can be saved. So I can have a chance and an opportunity to go to heaven and live with God forever. Eternal life. And this was shocking to me. It was like, that's just doesn't make sense that there is a God that could love me so much, could give up his own son's life and have Jesus go through the life that he went through, the betrayal and the beating and the crucifixion, and die on that cross so I can have a chance to go to heaven. So you can have a chance to go to heaven. So the Muslims can have a chance to go to heaven. Not just me, you know, we realize that the death of Jesus on the cross was for everyone in the world, including the Muslims and the Hindu and the Buddhist and the atheist, everyone else that's ever lived. But of course, although it's an inclusive act, it's also exclusive. It's also exclusive because as a believer of what Christ had done on that cross is when you have a chance to go to heaven. Because that's what Jesus says. Yeah, no one can come to the Father but through me. So now if we ponder on this and notice a couple of things that's very important. First of all, God is the one that's loving. God's the one that's giving. And something that's also very important is this. And I'm going to ask you this. As a believer in this verse, what is it that you are doing to contribute in this salvation? What is it that you're doing? No, I'm saying as a believer, what is it you're doing? You're doing nothing. Do you have to give money? Do you have to give up your life? Do you have to pray 5 times a day? Do you have to go to pilgrimage to Jerusalem or Mecca? Do you have to go and fight for Jesus? Do you have to kill others for Jesus? Do you have to be killed by others? No. Do you have to give almsgiving? No. You don't have to do anything. And salvation is done and it's over. And it's a gift for everyone to enjoy. And this is when I asked the pastor to make me Christian. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, you come to the church and I'll baptize you. So it was the case. And I had the first appointment available. And I went to the church and he baptized me. And I became Christian ever since then. And it's been almost 6 years now. And ever since then, I asked my pastor that I want to share this with our people, our congregations, our mission rallies, anything else that's out there, to show them a couple of things. One, the truth about Islam, and especially the politically incorrect Islam, the Islam that you need to know and understand so you are aware of this this religion and its impact throughout the world and the history. And for that, what I did is that I organized a PowerPoint presentation that's 15 hours long. But then I thought, 15 hours, that's too long. Let's cut it down. So I cut it down to 8 hours. And I realized 8 hours is too long, so I cut it down to four. So now I have four-part series about the religion of Islam. Three of the four parts are explanation, you know, informational, trivial stuff about Islam. What is this religion, the history, the doctrine, the theology, jihad, terrorism, women in Islam, Jesus in Islam, all of these things that you need to understand about this religion. And also, part four is about my own journey and how I came there that I just introduced you today. And I said I want to do this for two reasons. One, to educate our people, inform them about Islam. Second, to encourage our congregation members to also go reach out to others. Because the same way that someone reached out to me, if you do also, as it says in Romans 10:14, I mean, how can they believe unless they hear? And how can they hear unless someone tells them? Because that's what happened to me. How could I ever believe unless that person called me on the phone? And how could I ever believe unless that pastor studied the Bible with me? I mean, the Word did the conversion in me. It wasn't because of my intellect. It wasn't because anything else that I did. It's the Holy Spirit that does the conversion. And so this shows you how important it is and how crucial it is for all of us as Christians, because that someone here is all of us here. How important it is for us to go and tell others, people that we know, friends, family, neighbors, coworkers, college mates, those who are from a Muslim background, or even, you know, non-believers, how important it is to us to go and tell them about who we are and why we are Christian, and how joyful it is to have that burden of work righteousness lifted off your shoulders, especially the Muslims. Every day they have to do a schedule of things so they can score points, so they can have favors in the eyes of Allah. And they think that's the way to save themselves. But they don't know that there's another way. There's a better way. There's even actually one way to be saved, and that's through grace. Through grace of God. It's never going to happen through your own works. And these people need to hear it. There are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, and there are 5 to 7 million Muslims in America. And California is number one state in terms of Muslim population. They have more Muslims in California than any other state. So the opportunity is available. It's out there. It's everywhere that you could find. And even if you want to seek for it, there are everywhere to do. And exposing these people to the Word is going to change somebody's life, and it's going to bring them to faith. And the Holy Spirit does the conversion. It's not your effort, but it is important that you make that conveying the message to people. Because even, you know, whether you're young or old, remember I was only five when these kids were talking about Jesus being God. And that's like a seed. Every time you talk to a person about salvation, it's like a seed you plant in their lives, and it's going to come back one day and change somebody's life and radically bring them from where they are to a different level. And it did that to me, because remember I said I was an Iraqi Kurd, but I studied with a pastor, and so now I'm a pastorized Kurd. So So go ahead and tell your friends, your brothers, your family, your neighbors, your coworkers about the Christ, about the salvation, and about the grace of God and the gift that you have that they don't. And thank you very much for having me this morning. And God bless. Thank you. question.
Let me announce something first. Are you willing to take questions? Thank you, everyone, for attending so well today. I failed to make one announcement before we got started. If you would like to give a gift, a specific gift for Wells Muslim Outreach, we've put one of the offering plates right in the center here on your way out today. I think it will work best probably if people give cash, right, rather than trying to make out checks.
That gift is there. It's not for any purpose but to help me continue doing this. Throughout our synod and traveling expenses and my living, because I don't make cheese anymore. And so whatever you give is going to go to help me continue doing this. And, you know, the traveling expenses, lodging, food, airplane tickets, mileage, our budget that we have. The last 2 years has been all supported by, you know, free will offerings. And some of the budget comes from the Wells World Mission as well. So that's going to be the cause that if you give the money. Thank you.
And then it looks like we have about 8 minutes or so. It sounds like Jacob is willing to take a few questions from the audience.
Yes. Is it dangerous to tell a Christian story to Muslims? You mean personally? Upon me? Yes, for me, it's a dangerous thing to do because Islam doesn't look in favor to those who leave Islam. Because according to Islam, once you're Muslim, you're always Muslim. And if you leave Islam, the punishment for that is death. So they don't like what I do. So yes, one of the reasons why I go by the name Jacob and I travel and not announced and we don't do public stuff is because I would love to go and speak to the public, whether it's a university or any public gathering. But the problem with that is that we don't know who's going to be in the audience and who's going to react and what kind of reaction they'll see. That's why I do these things on a private base, on a Wells base. Sometimes I go to Missouri Lutherans and some Catholics as well. But primarily the audience are Christian because we don't know how the Muslims react. But I would love to go and speak to Muslims. But that's a dangerous thing to do. I mean, it's not that I'm afraid of them, but I have to be also aware that it's a silly thing to go among Muslims and announce myself. Hey, look at me! I'm a former Muslim. Let me tell you why. You know, that's not going to work. Yeah. Can we cancel the service today? No. And give you a break? No? Actually, there is. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. But there are some cultural things that you want to regard with Muslims. For example, if you're inviting them over, you know that you're not going to introduce them with pork or pigs or any kinds of pig products. They will not eat pork or ham or anything has to do with pigs. Alcohol is forbidden in Islam, so don't introduce alcohol unless you know that they drink alcohol. Dead meat, they will not eat dead meat. Blood, don't give them blood. They don't drink blood. Any meat that's been processed the commercial way, they will not eat it because it's not halal, so it must be done the Islamic way. Slaughter the animal, say the name of Allah on it, just like the kosher, the Jewish kosher. Don't argue with your Muslim friend or your non-believer friend because arguing is only going to increase the tension between you and them. Focus on what Christ had done, the message of salvation. Also focus on the concept of law and gospel and tell them about law and why law is there, why law was given to us by God. He gave us law for two purposes. One is to condemn you. The other is to show you your sin. Well, actually, let's reverse it. One is to show you your sin and the second is to condemn you, because he says, these are the sins that you commit every day, and this is what I'm going to condemn you with. And so you want to tell them that the law is not a way of salvation, because there is no way any of us can use the law as a way of salvation, because we have to be perfect in order for us to have the law as a way of salvation. We have to abide by it every time and all the time in order for us to have a chance to go to heaven through the law or via the law. So that means the only way of salvation is through the gospel and through the work that Jesus had done. Jesus came here and lived among us for 33 years or whatever length of time it was to do two things. One is to fulfill the law that we were given that condemns us and shows us our sin. And Jesus fulfilled it already. And the other one was to die and to pay the punishment for all of us instead of all of us. So when Jesus was on that cross, he was me, he was you, he was John and Matt and everyone else and Ahmed and Muhammad and all these names. He became all of us on that cross. In personal. Every person was represented by Jesus on that cross. Yes. Actually, you'll be surprised to know that there are a lot of Muslims who question their faith. And especially if they have a little bit of education, whether it's scientific or you know, college or anything that's somewhat educational, they will question their faith. However, it's not easy to break away from it. There's too much society pressure. There's too much religious pressure. There's too much loyalty pressure on the people to say, I'm done with this. I'm just going to walk away and not be a Muslim. And plus, you always have the threat of your life to be in danger, to be killed, to lose your family, to lose your friends, to lose everything that you have if you leave Islam. Yes. Okay. If she is dressed up in burqa and all that stuff, you can actually tell right away that she's Muslim. If she's not, it's harder to tell if they're Muslim or not. However, we did study yesterday at the LWS rally about women in Islam. And yes, that's one of the traditions that occurs in those cultures. Oh, yeah. That's another thing. Dogs are forbidden in Islam. Well, actually, pets in general are forbidden, except for birds and a fish in a bowl. But if you have a dog or a cat or a rat or anything like that, they're not going to touch it, or don't bring them up to them or anything like that, because to them, it's unclean. If a dog touches a Muslim accidentally, they have to wash that area 7 times. It's unclean. Well, I only have 2 brothers and 2 sisters left, and I've lost about 3 and 4 of my friends over this. They don't want to talk to me anymore. Not a whole lot of my family know about what's happening in my life, but if they know, I'm sure that they probably won't kill me, but they won't be very happy with what I do. So, yes. Yes. He's asking about politically correct Islam and politically incorrect Islam. When I talk about Islam, I talk about it the politically incorrect way, because I can bring you Islam for what it is. And I can teach you that this is what Islam is. This is how they teach things. But then when you hear about Islam from the mainstream media, from the Islamic media, they'll give you a politically correct version of Islam, and they'll try to portray it as the religion of peace and the religion of tolerance and the religion that respects women and the religion that does all these nice and beautiful things. But that is not true. That's not true. And it depends. You know, Islam is a very complicated religion, and it's very convoluted in some of the ways. It's very perverted as well. The mainstream media does that because, first of all, they don't want to get sued. Second, they don't want to entice something, and they should be, you know, they'll be called racist or any kinds of negative impact on their business. Thirdly, they do it because they themselves are ignorant. They don't know much about Islam. So that's why. You know, plus there's the notion of tolerance, you know, when you're talking about something, even if it's true, but if it causes disturbance, people don't want to talk about it because it's going to cause problems. Yes. All right. Well, it looks like we're out of time. So thank you so much and have a good day. Yes. Thanks so much. Well, we'll talk later. Thank you very much.
Okay. Since there are so many people in church, it's going to be really incumbent on us that we leave quickly so that the people for late service can come in. And if people could help removing some of the screen and that sort of thing, that will be helpful so we can get started with worship. Thank you very much, Jacob.